Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, September 22nd. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Analyst, Conoco committed to Permian. CEO, company wasn't expecting an invitation to bid on Shell's assets. By Mella McEwen. Executives at ConocoPhillips were surprised to be invited to bid on Shell's Permian Basin holdings, though it had been rumored Shell was preparing to market the assets. It was an invitation the company wasn't expecting or seeking, ConocoPhillips Chief Executive Officer Ryan Lance told investors during a webcast discussing the $9.5 billion cash transaction announced Monday. It's also the second major acquisition made by the company in less than a year, just shy of the $9.7 billion paid for Concho Resources. When the deal closes, ConocoPhillips will stand next to Pioneer Natural Resources as the Permian's second largest producer. Lance said during the Tuesday morning webcast that the acquisition made sense, but had to meet three critical criteria. Meet the company's strict cost of supply financial framework, provide incremental uplift from applying the company's commercial and technical skills, and make the company better. He told investors participating in the webcast that the deal raises free cash flow by $10 billion, provides a 7% increase in ordinary dividends, raises return on capital investment by 3%, and boosts greenhouse gas intensity reduction from 35 to 40% to now between 40 and 50%. Tim Leach, Concho's former chairman and chief executive officer, and now executive vice president, Lower 48 for ConocoPhillips, said neither company could have pursued the Shell assets alone, and the deal demonstrates the strength gained by the merger of two companies. A majority of Shell's Midland-based employees and many Houston-based employees are expected to be offered jobs with ConocoPhillips upon closing of the acquisition in the fourth quarter. Curtis Smith, spokesman for Shell U.S., told the Reporter Telegram by email, "We know that our Permian asset is in the highest quality area of the basin, and the team has done significant work to transform our operations and reduce unit operating costs by more than 50% since 2015. That being said, we also have acknowledged over the past year that our operated position was subscale and needed additional materiality to reach its competitive potential." Smith denied that the sale was related to efforts to shift to low carbon on net zero carbon operations and the energy transition. He stressed that the company's decision resulted after reviewing multiple strategies and portfolio options, including scaling up Shell's presence in the Permian. Since 2017, Shell's Permian operations have reduced greenhouse gas and methane intensity by 80% through investment in infrastructure and technology to be transferred to the buyer, with a commensurate 80% growth in production. These are important improvements that we are learning from and replicating in many parts of our upstream business as we pursue further carbon reductions across our business. He added that Shell has demonstrated that it has done a huge amount of work related to the environment, including investment and technology, to bring it to this competitive level, and undoubtedly a reason why it was attractive to ConocoPhillips. ConocoPhillips, Smith pointed out, was the first U.S.-based oil and gas company to adopt a Paris-aligned climate risk strategy with an ambition to achieve net zero operational emissions by 2050. In addition, net zero energy ambitions are part of ConocoPhillips' triple mandate, along with meeting transition pathway demand and delivering competitive returns. Andrew Dittmer, senior M&A analyst at the data analytics firm Enverus, told the Reporter Telegram by email that in the deal, the largest in over 3 years, ConocoPhillips is making a major commitment to shale and, in particular, the Permian Basin. That is an area that lagged in Conoco's portfolio for years, but has recently leapt to the forefront of its long-term plans. First, with the $13.3 billion acquisition of public Permian pure play Concho Resources in October 2020, and now with the acquisition of Shell's position, he wrote. The moves come at a time when shale is generating record cash flow for well-run E&Ps. However, new investment has slowed as companies prioritize getting capital back to shareholders and, in the case of the majors, also investing in energy transition projects. Those shifts, especially among the energy industry's largest players, seem to be creating opportunities for ConocoPhillips, Dittmar continued. After waiting patiently on M&A opportunities through the landrush years of the shale boom, Conoco has been able to pick up prime Permian real estate at what looks to be attractive price points. For example, in this deal, Conoco reports paying about $15,000 per acre for Shell's position, a fraction of the nearly $60,000 per acre Occidental paid for overlapping land in its purchase of Anadarko in 2019. Conoco's purchase of Concho also priced attractively at $10,000 per acre, per analysis by Enverus, he said. Conoco's ability to pay cash in a deal of this size likely contributed to the company successfully getting the assets at such an attractive price point. Grant Schwartzfelder, president and owner of OTA Environmental Services, told the reporter Telegram by telephone he found the impact on ESG numbers interesting. When Shell sells its properties, its ESG, environmental governance and social, numbers rise. But Conoco's numbers also rise after buying the assets, he observed. The larger companies have a high level of focus on ESG, focusing on best practices, and this raises their capabilities to manage emissions, he said. This article is entitled, Midland Bank VP Announces Candidacy. Jonna Smoot will be running for Midland County Judge, by Caitlin Randall. Jonna Smoot, vice president of West Texas National Bank, announced Tuesday she will be running for county judge of Midland County. Smoot said in a press release that her background in finance and marketing and experience working with community organizations has made her a strong candidate to lead Midland County. I believe that our best days are ahead, she said. Midland County deserves a leader who will put the needs of the community first and use our God-given resources to create a quality of life supported by low taxes, a strong economy, quality infrastructure, and safe communities. The focus of her campaign will be keeping property taxes low, improving roads and infrastructure, fully funding law enforcement and first responders, and securing future water rights, according to her campaign website. Smoot has served or participated on boards for the Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference, UTPB Advisory Board of the Shepherd Leadership Institute, Salvation Army, Midland Business and Professional Women, Midland Humane Coalition, Centers for Children, Midland Chamber of Commerce, and Midland Inspires. She grew up in Torrance, California, and moved to Midland in 2013. Smoot will be running in the Republican primary in spring 2022. The general election will be in November 2022. This article is called Small Bites. The tailgate provides perfect place to watch the big game. Murray's Deli is the anchor tenant for family-friendly location. By J.C. Lewis. The tailgate wants to cater to football fans, whether it be college football or NFL. Starting Saturday, the outdoor venue will open at 11 a.m. with the Texas Tech versus Texas game at 4401 North Big Spring Street. The venue will also show Texas A&M and Arkansas later in the day. The venue will be open until 9 p.m. The tailgate has also teamed up with Murray's Deli, which they said will be opening its own location there. Co-owners Sean Elphick and Ariel Herrera wanted to create a family-friendly place for Midlanders to enjoy the football season and other events throughout the year. "We decided to move on the idea in April," Elphick said. "There was a restaurant here called Taco Cabo, which had their lease end in April. The idea started off a lot smaller than it is now. The main thing we are trying to promote is a place where the entire family can hang out." Murray's Deli have a location on site, and there will also be different food trucks, a stage and video wall, as well as a 110-foot-long turf football field. Herrera added that there will be cornhole and trash can pong games to play, too. Food trucks confirmed for this weekend include Down South Seafood, Cane Doro Pizza, Kona Ice, and The Kitchen by Lori. This weekend, the tailgate will have one big 10-by-20-foot screen for feature games, and there will be other TVs set up to watch different games happening during the day. They will be getting a mixed beverage license for the end zone bar, but for now the venue is catering beer and wine. The venue will be open for food trucks from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. on weekdays and until midnight on weekends. Herrera and Elphick said they are also in talks to host a cornhole tournament and weekend yoga events. The Bites. Permian Basin Restaurant Week is happening this week at local restaurants in Midland and Odessa. Experience special menus at The Garlic Press, Opal's Table, 42, Venezia Restaurant, Butter, Lebra, 4110 Dining and Cocktails, Flair Taverna, The Legendary Barn Door, and Barrel and Derrick. Each menu is either $35 or $45 for three courses. 20% of every menu ordered will be donated to the West Texas Food Bank. Support Legacy High School Rebel Marching Band this Thursday at the Whataburger, located at 3206 North Midkiff Road. The fundraiser will be from 6 to 9 p.m., and a portion of the proceeds will be donated back to the LHS Marching Band. Tall City Brewing Company announced this year's Oktoberfest event. Join Tall City Brewing Company from October 1st to October 3rd for fun, crazy games, discount on beers, and German-inspired dishes by food trucks. Odessa will be getting a new human bean. Construction is currently happening at 2611 FM 1936 by Petromechanical Services. Shipley's Donuts will open a second location in town at 2201 West Wall Street. Owners expect to open in January. Celebrate National Pancake Day this Friday at Midland College's June and Frank Cowden Jr. Dining Hall. Flapjacks will be served all day long in honor of National Pancake Day. Tickets are $6 for current MC students and employees, or $9 for the public. Hours on Friday are 7 a.m. to 1:20 p.m. and 5 to 7 p.m. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled "Midland ISD Examines Its YWLA Problem," by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD is looking to take care of its Young Women's Leadership Academy problem. The district has an entire all-girls school being run out of portables, and the school's staff, students, and some board members are not happy about it. The problem is great enough that two board members, John Trashitti III and Katie Joyner, wanted to close down Jones Elementary in March and hand over the facility to the charter operator that is a partner with the district. Other board members stated that it was not fair to push those students out without providing parents any notice, and that the district should do its due diligence about options. That is where the district is now, according to Kelly Spencer, the district's chief administrative services. The Davis demographic study presented to the council on Monday might help identify slower growing areas in Midland and maybe help present a possible campus to turn over to YWLA if needed. Spencer told the Reporter Telegram that school officials expect to present a solution to the board by the end of the calendar year. If we are going to move YWLA into an existing facility, we need growth data to make sure the move is possible, said Spencer, who added that the district can't just displace other students just to give YWLA students a building. At Monday's meeting, three people representing YWLA spoke during the public comment period of the board meeting. They talked about how YWLA had grown, the inconveniences of sharing land with a neighboring elementary school, defects in the portable facilities on the campus in Southwest Midland. They said YWLA can't compete with other programs because of the lack of facilities. They commented how the district broke promises of a Hockaday-like experience. Hockaday is an all-girls private school in North Dallas with an annual tuition between $28,950 and $34,350. They talked about how YWLA is one of the top performing schools in the district and that the facilities provided should match that performance. YWLA opened in the fall of 2019 with the 6th and 7th grades. It currently is home to girls in grades 6 to 9. It is run by the Dallas-based Young Women's Preparatory Network. Some may remember that YWLA was part of the last bond issue presented by the district in 2019. School officials had hoped Young Women's Preparatory Network could run the in-district charter out of the building that is now home to San Jacinto Junior High. Had the bond passed, SJ would have eventually moved into the buildings where Midland High currently exists, and then YWLA would have moved in to the Central Midland campus. Spencer said the district had to be innovative and offer academic choices that the community is wanting, and that there needs to be a long-range facilities plan to support that offering. She said YWLA's existence in portables was never meant to be permanent, and that the goal is to put YWLA students in facilities that any student in the district would deserve. This article is entitled Investigation Open into Mask Mandate Ban by Megan Menchaca, Austin American Statesman. The U.S. Department of Education has opened an investigation into Governor Greg Abbott's ban on mask mandates in Texas schools, according to a letter Tuesday sent to the state's top education official. The investigation by the department's Office of Civil Rights will focus on whether Texas is violating federal law by preventing disabled students from safely returning to in-person classes. Suzanne Goldberg, Acting Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, sent the letter to Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath, informing him of the investigation. OCR is concerned that Texas's restriction on schools and school districts from putting masking requirements in place may be preventing schools in Texas from meeting their legal obligations not to discriminate based on disability and from providing an equal educational opportunity to students with disabilities who are at heightened risk of severe illness from COVID-19, the letter said. According to the letter, the department's civil rights office will review whether schools are being prevented from making individual decisions about mask use to allow students to receive a free public education and to be free from discrimination based on their disability. OCR will examine whether, in light of Texas's prohibition on local school districts and schools from requiring the use of masks, TEA may be preventing school districts in the state from considering or meeting the individual educational needs of students with disabilities or otherwise enabling discrimination based on disability in violation of Section 504 and Title II, the letter said. Abbott has issued an executive order prohibiting agencies that receive public funding in Texas from instituting mask requirements. Multiple school districts, including Austin ISD, have defied the governor, and required masks amid a surge in cases due to the Delta variant of COVID-19. Last week, the Texas Education Agency released an updated public health guidance that said school systems in the state could not require students or staff to wear a mask based on Abbott's executive order. A spokesperson for the agency did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Earlier, the agency had said Abbott's ban on mask mandates would not be enforced while legal challenges to his executive order proceeded. Several such challenges are still pending before or on their way to the Texas Supreme Court. The investigation into Texas comes weeks after the department notified state education leaders in five states, Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Utah, of an investigation into their bans on mask mandates for similar reasons. Texas was not originally investigated because its mask mandate was not being enforced in the face of ongoing litigation. This article is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Key Members. OPEC Plus Can Proceed with Reviving Supply, by Anthony DePaola, Grant Smith, Selma Elwardeny, and Verity Ratcliffe from Bloomberg. OPEC and its allies can likely continue reviving oil production, two key Middle East members said as the group prepares to consider its next supply hike. The plan is working. We're gradually increasing and the market is absorbing it, United Arab Emirates Oil Minister Suhail Al-Mazrui said on Tuesday at the GasTech conference in Dubai. I don't see any reason why we should deviate from that. Mazrui's view echoes comments from his Iraqi counterpart over the weekend, as well as delegates from several other OPEC Plus nations speaking privately. The 23-nation OPEC Plus coalition is restoring crude supplies halted when the pandemic crushed global fuel demand last year. The group, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, will meet on October 4th to review the next monthly increment of 400,000 barrels a day. Other prominent voices from the alliance agreed that the group can continue with this plan. We already agreed we would be giving some additional quota to all the countries on a month-by-month basis, so we will just be doing that for now, Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum, Timipre Silva, said in an interview. The group will proceed cautiously, and if, for any reason, we see demand is slacking, then we'll have to do something about reducing our quotas. Nigeria is currently producing below its OPEC quota because of difficulties related to oil export terminals, Silva said. The country is working to resolve those technical issues and expects to reach its output target within a month, he said. Iraqi oil minister Ihsan Abdul Jabbar said on Sunday that he expects the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its partners to stick to plans for a November crude production increase if prices stay at current levels, though it's too early to determine the result of the group's meeting next month. Benchmark Brent crude is currently trading around $75 a barrel, up about 45% this year. The market will remain in balance through the first quarter of 2022, with oil hovering around $70 a barrel, if OPEC Plus keeps its plans, Jabbar predicted. Another boost in exports from OPEC would probably be welcomed by consumers, helping to offset losses in U.S. supply caused when Hurricane Ida battered the Gulf Coast last month. The storm initially shuttered 1.7 million barrels a day, and the industry is still struggling to restart many of the affected fields. While global markets are experiencing tightness now, some forecasts point to a lull early next year. Morgan Stanley and Standard Chartered predict that OPEC Plus will need to pause its monthly output boosts to prevent the formation of a new oversupply. Mazrui countered that view in his remarks on Tuesday, saying that OPEC Plus isn't concerned about a surplus in the second quarter of 2022. This article is entitled, Shell Shows That It Favors Investor Returns Over Renewable Deals, by Laura Hurst, Bloomberg. Royal Dutch Shell PLC proved it's taking a different approach to the energy transition. As the company's European peers pull billions into offshore wind farms and solar projects, Shell chose to give its latest influx of cash back to shareholders. Investors still have reservations over the fossil fuel industry's plans to switch from historically high return oil and gas projects to potentially less profitable low-carbon energy. Shell's promise that three-quarters of the proceeds from the $9 billion sale of its Permian shale business will be returned to shareholders should alleviate fears any incremental free cash will be sunk into renewables, Redburn analyst Stuart Joyner said in a note. Shell and its closest rival, BP PLC, have similar plans for slashing their greenhouse gas emissions. Neither have been rewarded by investors, with shares for both companies still down some 30% since they announced their strategies. While BP has explicitly said it will partly fund the expansion of its low-carbon business by selling off some oil and gas assets, Shell has taken a more cautious approach. Instead of spending billions of dollars acquiring big projects, it's focusing on organic growth, building electric vehicle charging stations, carbon capture and storage, making alternative fuels at new and existing facilities. Last week, it signed off on plans to build a biofuel facility on the site of a large oil refinery in the Netherlands. It's questionable whether this gradual expansion can keep pace with the shrinking of its fossil fuel business. This year, Shell has handed back concessions in Tunisia, sold its onshore Egyptian assets, and is in talks to divest its large onshore oil field portfolio in Nigeria. The company operated 54 refineries in 2004, but soon will have just 5 major energy and chemical sites left. Some argue that shrinking and returning capital is the right strategy in a world of energy transition, analysts at Citigroup Inc. said in a note. But there's little indication that the sale of Shell's Permian assets generated any extra value for shareholders, they said. This article is entitled ConocoPhillips Sees Pre-COVID Demand Returning, by Alex Steele and Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. ConocoPhillips sees oil demand returning to pre-pandemic levels by early next year as crude consumption rises around the world, supporting higher commodity prices, Chief Executive Officer Ryan Lance said on Bloomberg TV. Oil supply, on the other hand, will remain constrained both from OPEC Plus, U.S. shale fields, and major oil companies embracing the energy transition, he said. We see the demand improving. We see probably getting back to pre-pandemic levels by the end of fourth quarter or the first quarter of next year, and the market getting relatively balanced, Lance said. We're pretty bullish on the next couple of years. Investment banks and OPEC analysts have been raising demand forecasts in recent weeks as economies rebound, and Europe's natural gas squeeze raises the prospect of power generators switching to crude. Both trends are positive for oil prices, which are up 45% this year, but have stalled below $75 a barrel for most of the last few months. ConocoPhillips' $9.5 billion purchase of Royal Dutch Shell's PLC's Permian Basin assets gives the company a low cost of supply, so it can meet demand whatever happens in the energy transition, Lance said. The world is going through an energy transition. There will be increased demand for the product going forward, so we want to be in the best basins, the lowest cost of supply basins around the world, and that's what Permian Basin represents, Lance said. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, September 22nd. Coy Dwayne Willis. Coy Dwayne Willis, age 71, after a courageous three-month battle with a lung illness, was welcomed to his eternal home by our Lord and Savior with his sweetheart Kay by his side on September 18th. Funeral will be Wednesday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at Morrison Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Pioneer Cemetery under the direction of Morrison Funeral Home. Coy was born January 4, 1947, to Troy O. Willis and Lily Mae Apne Willis in Brownfield, Texas. Coy was preceded in death by his father, Troy O. Willis, and mother, Lily Mae Apne Willis, and brothers Troy Lee Willis, John H. Willis, and Roy W. Willis, and granddaughter Courtney Renee Cates. Coy is survived by his committed and loving wife, Kay Willis, daughters Brenda and husband Roald Claysons of Haskell, Texas, Barbara and husband Fred Cates of Stanton, Bobby and husband Richard Barksdale of Abilene, and Joy and husband Roger Peterson of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He is also survived by his brother Jimmy Willis and sister Annette Willis Riggs and husband Ronnie Riggs, all of Post, Texas, as well as his special sister-in-law Carolyn Ray Willis of Lubbock. To honor Coy's memory in lieu of flowers, please make donations to the Humane Society of Young County, 120 Craig Street, Graham, Texas, 76450. Visitation will be Tuesday, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Morrison Funeral Home Chapel. David Ray Fullen, Sr. David Ray Fullen, Sr., 82, of Eastland, Texas, passed away on September 17th in Eastland. David was born in Whiteface, Texas, to W.B. and Nellie Fullen on April 20th, 1939. He is preceded in death by his wife Edna, his parents, his daughter Connie, and his sister Mary Lindsay. He is survived by his siblings W.B. Jr. and Carolyn, Carol Hale, Laverne and Waylon Pierce, Deanne and Roland Whitaker, Jerry Fullen, Laura Wilson. Sons, David, Beau, and Sherry Fullen, Gary and Karen Fullen, 11 grandchildren, and 10 great-grandchildren. Graveside services will be at 10 a.m. September 22nd at Sunset Memorial Gardens with Reverend Jimmy Braswell officiating. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. James Harley Melton. James Harley Melton, 40, of Odessa, passed away on Sunday, September 19th. Celebration of life will be held on Thursday, September 23rd at 2 p.m. at Nellie Picklin Welch Chapel. Harley was born on July 29, 1981, in Odessa. He is survived by his children Elijah, Ashlyn, and Hallie, the love of his life Rhiannon, his mother and father, Kathy and Johnny Henderson, his siblings Amy Rosenberger, Lori, Jacob, and Brittany, and numerous nieces and nephews. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. K. Gwen Posey. K. Gwen Posey, 82, went to her Heavenly Savior Sunday, September 19th. Kay was born and raised in Roscoe, Texas. Kay is preceded in death by her husband, Robert, father Jack L. Fitz of Houston, mother Dorothy L. Sowell of Midland, and brothers Jack and Kenneth Fitz. She is survived by her two sons, Lance Posey and wife Pam, and Dale Posey. Daughter Melissa Lopez. Extended family members, Linda Posey, Giles of Stephenville, Debbie Giles, Dillingham, and husband J.D. of Austin, and Kent Giles of Stephenville. She was an amazing Jima to 7 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. Graveside services will be 1 p.m. Friday, September 24th, at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland, with Reverend Paul Thompson officiating. The family suggests memorials be directed to Kindred Hospice, Midland, 1031 Andrews Highway, Suite 203, Midland, 79703. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. to place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Kenneth Wayne Chastain. Kenneth Wayne Chastain, 92, a loving husband and father, was called to be with the Lord on September 20th. Kenneth was born in Brazos, Texas, the son of Jesse and Willie Faye Chastain, on January 5th, 1929. Kenneth is survived by his loving and devoted wife of 53 years, Jackie Chastain of Granbury, son and daughter-in-law Michael and Dolores Chastain of Lone Camp, daughter Pawnee Barnes and fiancé David Holmes of Granbury, sister Marcia Williams and husband James of Fort Worth, 5 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. He will be greatly missed by his family and friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, brother J.W. Chastain, and great-grandson Boston J. Percival. Graveside services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 22nd, at Dobbs Valley Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Dobbs Valley Cemetery Association. Condolences may be left at www.bcbfuneralhome.com. Lydia Lara Mendoza. Lydia Lara Mendoza, 65, from Midland, passed away on September 14th. Lydia was born and raised in Pecos, Texas. She is survived by her sisters, Virginia Rodriguez, Paul from Beaumont, Alicia Curtis, Robert from Fort Stockton, Esperanza Hope Reyes, Iloncio from League City, and Maria Mary Meissner from Midland, as well as many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, Alberto and Bertha Mendoza, sister Elida Mendoza, grandmother Valentina Mora, and her niece Evelyn Mae Curtis. Viewing will be on September 24th, and an evening service will be held at 7 p.m. that day. Burial will be on October 1st at 10 a.m. at Serenity Memorial Gardens. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made on behalf of Lydia Mendoza to the American Cancer Society. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Victoria Ann Kern. Victoria Ann Kern, 57, passed away on Thursday, September 16th at Baylor Scott and White Hospital in Grapevine. She was born on January 18, 1964, in Fort Worth to James Lawson Upham and Patricia Ellen Nance Upham. Victoria grew up in Midland. She was preceded in death by her mother, Patricia Upham. Those left to cherish Victoria's memories are her husband, Jim Kern, daughter, Brenna Martin, and husband, Sawyer, son, Dalton Kern, granddaughter, Avery, beloved dog, Dobby, father, James Upham, and wife, Susan, brother, Robert Upham, father-in-law, William Kern, and wife, Patricia, brothers-in-law, David Kern and Douglas Kern, sister-in-law Kathleen Kern, as well as nieces and nephews. A celebration of life service will be held at Emerald Hills Funeral Home, 500 Kennedale Sublette Road, Kennedale, Texas, 76060, on Thursday, September 23rd at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorial donations be made to www.shelter2rescue.org or the American Cancer Society. Cameron Douglas Combs. Cameron Douglas Combs was born on August 7, 2002 in Odessa. On September 14th, our world lost a little bit of its warmth with Cameron's unexpected and sudden passing in Pflugerville, Texas. Cameron is preceded in death by his great-grandfather Jimmy Rance Stroud and uncles Dean Anderson and Darren Anderson. He is survived by his mother, Brittany Hennessy, and husband, Ryan, father, Caleb Combs, and wife, Tara, sister, Mackenzie, great-grandmother, Doris Wannell Stroud, paternal grandparents, Lyndia Anderson and Gregory Morris, paternal grandparents Diane and Dean Combs, and numerous aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, September 25th at the station on Mercer in Dripping Springs, Texas, from 10:45 a.m. to 1 p.m.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. Council approves tax rate for 2021-22 by Frederico Martinez. The Odessa City Council voted 6-0 to set the 2021-22 fiscal year tax rate at 0.477115 cents during their Tuesday work session. Assistant City Manager of Administrative Services, Cindy Muncy, said the proposed tax rate is the same as the 2020-21 fiscal year, but is projected to increase city revenue by $587,774. City Manager Michael Marrero said the revenue increase is expected due to increased property values and additional housing in the city. Setting the tax rate requires two votes by council. The council voted 7-0 in favor during their September 14th meeting. Councilwoman Denise Swanner did not attend Tuesday's work session, which resulted in the 6-0 vote. Marrero said he expected to have a proposed contract agreement ready for council consideration on September 28th that would result in the city donating a plot of vacant downtown property to Odessa College. The property is the former site of the Odessa American Building, which was purchased in 2016 for about $1.6 million as part of a downtown revitalization effort. The city paid $345,000 to remove the asbestos, demolish the building, and clear the land. Odessa College officials recently requested the property at 4th Street and Jackson, where they plan to invest $1.5 million to create green space and landscaping and construct a stage area for community concerts and events. The proposed plan would also include the installation of a new splash pads, seating areas, and additional programs and activities designed to attract a younger crowd downtown, school officials have said. The college's long-term plan includes construction of a new three-story school building that would house the college's entrepreneurial classes and serve as the site for a business incubator where students could launch new businesses. On Tuesday, council reviewed a request from the Fire Rescue Department to purchase a 2019 Deemers Ford F-450 ambulance chassis for $332,370. The vehicle would be purchased from Siddons Martin Emergency Group, LLC, in Denton, Texas. The department would also like to purchase additional equipment for the vehicle, including a cardiac monitor, $29,999.09, a computer, $5,926.17, and a radio system, $16,800. The purchase of the vehicle and equipment would be paid for through the Fire Rescue's Equipment Services account, Chief John Alvarez said. Alvarez said the ambulance is needed due to increase in services and COVID-19 calls. This vehicle, which was previously used as a demo, would be delivered and ready to use in 2 to 3 months. Alvarez said ordering a new vehicle would take more than 1 year to be delivered due to high demand throughout the country. Council, which has previously expressed support for the purchase, will vote on the request at next Tuesday's council meeting. Grow Our Own Network, Progressing. OA News at OAOA.com. Progress on the Grow Our Own Action Network and an Office for the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin were reported during a Zoom meeting of the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin Tuesday. Jonathan Fuentes, Executive Dean of Academic Partnerships at OC, chairs the committee along with Lisa Weinman and Courtney Wardlaw. Education Partnership Executive Director Adrian Vega said the purpose of the Grow Our Own Action Network is to identify, align, and leverage community resources that lead to increased post-secondary success, workforce development, and a stronger community. Fuentes said they looked at penetration rates in different ways that career and technical education is paid for, whether it's by the school district or by parents or a combination of both. Some districts pay for the full amount of dual credit, Fuentes said. We're excited about what we're uncovering and we're getting quite a bit of data, Fuentes said. We're serving about 50 high schools. As a district starts paying for more dual credit, he said, it is starting to trend upward in terms of having more penetration within your high school. In explaining penetration, he said, we took the number of dual credit students that are served at each high school and then divided it by the total number of high school students to end up at a penetration rate. Fuentes said they are excited about the data they are uncovering and are working on goal setting. On the other side, we're thinking about the CTEs, Career and Technical Education. What are districts doing in terms of CTE programs? And we have a survey that has been developed and will be shared out to the different school district. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to figure out what do school districts currently offer and where would they like to expand next and what are the barriers to that expansion, Fuentes said. That will also help us start setting those themes that we're uncovering across the Permian Basin, so that we can then add goals, he added. And so dual credit, advanced classes, these are a couple of the CCMR, College Career Military Readiness, indicators to see whether school districts are graduating students that are more prepared, if you will, Fuentes said. Co-chairman Lorraine Perryman said, the partnership is in the process of leasing an office across from the Region 18 Education Service Center. Bridget Worley, Executive Director of the Texas Impact Network, talked about what House Bill 3, passed by the state legislature in 2019, looks like in the basin. On the teacher incentive allotment, Ector County led the way applying in Cohort C with Dr. Murray. They were approved and implemented their program last year, so they'll be submitting their data to get full TEA approval in November, Worley said. Greenwood, Midland, and Stanton all applied last April in Cohort D and were all approved by TEA to implement their program this year and collect the data to then get full approval a year following Ector County. So huge teacher incentive allotments take up in the Permian Basin, which is going to lead to more funding for the highest performing teachers in your school systems to help retain them and then also ideally recruit other great educators, Worley said. The additional day school year opportunity is the program where you can get state funding for up to 30 additional days in your elementary school instructional calendar. Worley said Ector County and Pecos are both implementing the summer model. Midland is implementing an intersessional model to occur throughout the year instead of in the summer, Worley said. Getting jabbed. University of Texas Permian Basin nursing student Mackenzie Woody left administers a vaccine at a drive-through COVID-19 vaccination clinic Tuesday at the UTPB soccer complex parking lot. City of Odessa, the University of Texas Permian Basin, and the Ector County Health Department worked together to administer Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Vaccinations will continue from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesdays through Fridays until the demand decreases. First and second shots will be offered. Third shots will only be available with a doctor's note, regardless of the amount of time that has passed. Information on booster shots is subject to change in accordance with CDC guidelines. No appointment or pre-registration is needed. Oil field welders in demand. Companies say the best practitioners earn top dollar, by Bob Campbell. There's nothing easy about being a welder in the oil field, but then you wouldn't expect there to be in a job paying $66,000 a year to the masters of the craft. Spokesmen for companies in Odessa and Midland and for the Permian Basin Workforce Development Board say it's a profession that always has openings for the specialties of pipe welding, gas tungsten arc welding, gas metal arc welding, fitter welding, metal insert gas welding, finishing technicians and fabricators who create metal structures by cutting, bending, and assembling. Adam Urabis, Vice President for Fabrication at J&J Steel and Supply, said his shop had a full staff of 20 welders among its 40 employees who build field-erected oil tanks ranging in capacity from 1,000 to 20,000 barrels and make parts for tanks holding from 50,000 to 1 million gallons that have been shipped as far as California, Fort Worth, and Houston, and to a military base on the South Pacific island of Guam. We also make gasoline and diesel tanks, frac tanks, small production tanks, pipe racks, supports, and solar energy platforms, Urabis said. We don't do any aluminum welding. The majority is stainless and carbon steel. He said the J&J welders all use arc welders wearing hoods with dark lenses to protect their eyes and don't do acetylene welding with a torch, which is usually for artwork. Ask about the staff who take portable rigs with gasoline-powered engines to drilling sites to join lengths of casing pipe, Uribus said, rig welding is a broad category where the welder has his own machine to go wherever he needs to go. He said the advanced practitioners can work all around and upside down to connect horizontal pipes, which in their profession is called 6G ability. No more than 25% know how to lay out things, read drawings, and run 4 or 5 guys, Uribus said. As soon as they know that, they start their own companies. He said J&J has been called on by big companies to replace 3 or 4 tanks in the past 4 or 5 years that have burned down after they were struck by lightning. Odessa College and Midland College have welders training programs for which financial aid is available. Program specialist Rosemary Casas of the Permian Basin Workforce Development Board said welders, cutting torch men, solderers, and brazeners have always been needed in the Permian Basin and always will be. At the end of June, Casas said 1,535 welders were at work in the 17-county region and there were 209 openings. There are probably more working now since the state stopped the extended unemployment benefits, she said. Casas said beginners were earning $40,600 a year and experienced men $65,900 for an average of $53,250. Polar Service Center's branch manager, Burl Mayberry of Midland, supervises the repair of tanker trailers, fuel trailers, acid trailers, crude oil trailers, and vacuum trailers. Reporting he had one welder and needed another, Mayberry said, 95% of our work is aluminum TIG welding. There is an art to welding in aluminum because it doesn't change colors when you heat it, and it can just suddenly fall out on you. TIG is for tungsten inert gas or gas tungsten arc welding. We can make repairs on just about anything, and we can build a trailer from the ground up, Mayberry said. Running up and down these lease roads, they crack real bad. He said becoming an excellent welder takes patience and lots of practice. We get a young guy to run a few beads and see where he is at, Mayberry said. Everybody can be taught, but the test is, will he make it with aluminum? Quick hits. Restaurant Week. The West Texas Food Bank has 9 area restaurants offering a special menu through Friday, with a percentage being donated back to the West Texas Food Bank. Participating restaurants include Flair Tavernade, the legendary Barn Door Steakhouse, Beryl and Derek at the Odessa Marriott, and 4110, all in Odessa. The Garlic Press, Opal's Table, 42, Venetia Restaurant, Butter, and Librado, all in Midland. Diners must ask for and order the special Permian Basin Restaurant Week menu, which will be priced at either $35 or $45. 20% of every Permian Basin Restaurant Week menu ordered will be donated to WTFB. For restaurant menus or more information, visit wtxfoodbank.org/permian-basin-restaurant-week. St. Anne's Family Fair. The 73rd annual St. Anne's Family Fair has been scheduled for Thursday through Sunday at St. Anne's Catholic Church, 1906 West Texas Avenue in Midland. Carnival hours are from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Thursday, 6 p.m. to midnight Friday, and Saturday and 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. Sunday. The fair will take place from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday. The fair features fun and entertainment for all ages with over 65 food and game booths, including smoke-free bingo, face painting, games for kids, and odds and ends garage sale booth. General admission is free. All proceeds benefit the Texas Ann School and Parish. West Texas Fest. The Ellen Noel Art Museum has scheduled the 5th annual West Texas Fest, Spirits of Texas, October 1st at the Midland Shooters Association Shotgun Range, 7400 West County Road, 170 in Midland. VIP hour is 6 p.m., general admission is 7 p.m., and cornhole tournament will start at 7:45 p.m. There will be Texas beer, wine, and tastings tied along with local food trucks, music, and cornhole tournament. This event is a fundraiser put on by Ellen Noel Art Museum to help raise the funds needed to continue their mission to providing art exhibits, educational programs, workshops for all ages, free community art days, and much more for the Permian Basin. The Shotgun Range will be closed. Sponsorships are available. Online ticket sales end at noon, October 1st. Pink the Basin Benefit. Saving True Pairs, One Mammogram at a Time, 9th Annual Sporting Clays event will benefit Pink the Basin, October 8th at Jake's 13301 FM 1379 in Midland. A raffle for Browning Satori Field Sporting Grade 7 Shotgun will also be held. Tickets are $20 each. All proceeds raised for Saving True Pairs and Pick the Basin staying the Permian the Basin. Sponsorships are available. Trade Days. Old Sorehead Trade Days has been scheduled from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. October 9th and from noon to 5 p.m. October 10th on downtown streets in Stanton. There will be more than 600 vendors who will bring wood crafts, wearable art, hand-poured candles, metal art, antiques, jewelry, collectibles, clothing, food, and more.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.